This is exciting time. We're now going to be listening to the final interview of Alternative to Sleeping. 7 years leading up right to this moment. We're going to start with a nice tag that was recorded, and then we're going to get right into my interview with Dr. Demento. He is the guy who invented comedy on the radio. And he is the guy who jump-started and really helped create Weird Al Yankovic's career. Weird Al, my number one idol. So I thought there was no better way to end a comedy radio show than with the man himself, Dr. Demento.
Hi, this is Dr. Demento, and you're listening to Ethan Ullman on WCDB 90.9 in Albany. And don't forget to stay demented.
You're listening to Alternative to Sleeping with Ethan Ullman here on WCDB Albany 90.9 FM and Comedy Pipe Radio. And I'm very excited to welcome this guy is the inventor of comedy radio. So the most apropos final guest ever. There's no one better than the great, the legendary Dr. Demento. How's it going, Dr. D?
Oh, real fine. Woo! Woo! Wind up your radio. Hello, Albany. Hello, Comedy Pipe Radio. Hello, Ethan.
Hey, thank you so much for doing this. This is really, truly an honor to be speaking with you.
Same here, Ethan.
Yeah, it's so I've been doing the show for 7 years. Not quite as long as you've been doing your show, but I certainly wouldn't have been here without you pioneering the comedy radio genre.
Well, I'm glad to help launch your career then.
You've launched many careers, including Weird Al's, and I do want to speak about that later, but
sure.
I guess I wanted to, I kind of have a timeline I wanted to go through. I have some questions. I guess first, let's just get this out of the way. For those listening, where did the name Dr. Demento come from, and where did the idea for the radio show come from?
Well, it started out as a rare oldie show, and I found after a while that the more novelty records that I played, things like the Purple People Eater and Transfusion and They're Coming to Take Me Away, haha, to the Funny Farm. The more things like that that I played, the more popular the show seemed to be. So I thought, well, I think I'm on to something, so I'm going to run with that. And the name came from a fellow named Steven Siegel, a.k.a. the obscene Stephen Clean. I happened to get to know him through some mutual friends, and he was a disc jockey in Pasadena, right outside Los Angeles, and he invited me to the station he was on, and that was favorably received. There were lots of calls saying, bring him on again, things like that, and he gave me the name. He came up with the name Dr. Demento. He, if you ask him, he'll say that he first thought of it when he was hanging out with Peter Wolfe, who was the lead singer of the Jay Giles band that was very popular for many years. And they were good friends. And so Stephen gives him part credit for thinking up the name.
And it just stuck. Did you start using it immediately?
It just stuck, yeah. Stephen started using it when he introduced me. Before I had my own show, I was a guest on his show quite a few times. It was kind of a regular thing. And about the fourth time I was on with him, he just said, and now here's Dr. Demento. And it just stuck. he did not ask me first if I wanted to be Dr. Demento.
But you liked it. You liked the name?
Yeah.
Okay.
It stuck. Yeah.
Yeah.
For better or worse, and mostly for better.
Now, I haven't heard of any other DJ before you playing the novelty comedy music strictly. Was there anyone that you had listened to or heard of before you started?
Nobody
doing it?
Really influenced me in terms of doing it. I just knew that I wanted to play records for people.
Right.
There were some people who played comedy records on the air before me that... best known mostly in the Los Angeles area was a guy named Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. He made a few records, so it's not totally forgotten, but he had a show in the 1940s and 50s where he played a lot of comedy records.
Okay.
He played old stuff that was old then.
Right. Now,
and he also made some records of his own that were not national hits, but they're still around.
Now, when you started to transition from the rarities rock stuff into the novelty comedy stuff, were there any road bumps from program managers or program directors?
No, I was on a freeform station.
Okay.
That was a brief era in the history of radio where even on commercial stations, just about anything went on certain stations. They called it underground radio, progressive radio, freeform radio. There were lots of names for it. Mm-hmm. There were a few stations around the country. Probably the best known one on the East Coast was WBCN in Boston. And in our town, it was KPPC in Pasadena, and that's where I was lucky enough to catch on. And really, before management knew it, I'd kind of evolved to doing funny stuff. And as long as it got a good reaction and people listened, they were fine with it.
Early on, did you have any... Oh, I'm sorry.
So occasionally there would be objections to certain things that I played. Not very often, but it happened. But they certainly went along with the idea of playing funny stuff in general.
As far as other disc jockeys, did you have like a... Was there a lack of respect because you weren't playing, you know, the typical stuff?
Not really.
You never ran into that?
No, I didn't feel... It was something different and something that most of the people who tuned in... I mean, either they rejected it right away and went back to listening to Led Zeppelin, or they loved it. It seemed that way.
You started as a... You were a DJ in college in...
Yes.
Portland, Oregon, yeah. Reed College.
That's right. So I became the station manager. It's a very small station. Reed is a relatively small college, and the station was not really a big deal, but a lot of people had fun with it, and I certainly did. When I started there, the station played mostly classical music.
Okay.
And during the time that I was there, it evolved to being a more freeform. Now, this was the early 60s, before there were any real freeform commercial stations. There were certainly some other wacky shows on college and non-commercial radio at that time. But basically, the Dr. Demento show developed in a vacuum. It evolved. The listeners, I followed what the listeners wanted to hear. And there seemed to be a trend after a while in favor of the... things that were called novelty records at that time, like the ones I just mentioned.
Right.
And I gradually expanded it to other forms of comedy that were on record, such as Tom Lehrer or Alan Sherman, and then Frank Zappa, of course. Of course, on that station, they played Frank Zappa all the time. It wasn't just me.
Right.
Because it was a crazy freeform station. And Zappa was just kind of launching his career, and he was based in Los Angeles, so we were all very much in touch with Frank Zappa and his fans.
Now, you first wanted to do, you first knew that you wanted to get into radio at a young age when you started collecting records?
Yeah, I started collecting records, and then at our high school, we would have record hops. Sock hops, because we danced in the gym and they didn't want to mark up the floor with street shoes, so we danced in our socks. That was common at a lot of schools in those days, but we had our sock hops, and we had a relatively small high school, so the school did not bring in disc jockeys from the local AM Top 40 stations. Instead, we just students would bring their own records and play them, and when I got to be a junior, I by that time, I had the biggest record collection, so I was usually the guy who played the records. And I didn't talk much. My talking was limited to dedications. We sold dedications for a dime.
Okay.
You could pay a dime, and I'd say, now for Bill and Judy, here's Confidential by Sonny Knight. And that's about all the talking that I would do in those days. But in college radio, I got to do more talking, different things. We were a classical station, and now here is Beethoven's Symphony No. 4, Arturo Toscanini, and the NBC Symphony Orchestra. You know, trying to be restrained and dignified.
Right.
And then I got to playing blues. I was a big blues fan, even back then. Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and that kind of thing. So I had a show a blues show, and then I had a Folk Music Unlimited show.
Wow.
Because those were the days of the folk boom.
Right.
So, of course, everybody remembers, who went through that era, remembers the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, but I tended to play more either people like Pete Seeger, or I would play real traditional music from the mountains and from the deep south. More and more of that was becoming available on records, so that's what I'd play. So that was me in college at KRRC, Reed College Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the student manager of the station because I seemed to have more enthusiasm for it than the other kids did. So So that was how I started in radio.
When you were a young boy around 12, you started collecting the 78s. Did you know what you were looking for, or were you kind of just experimenting, looking at cover art?
It was mostly trial and error. I knew a little bit. My mother had grown up in the 20s and 30s, and she remembered songs from that era. And she had told me about some of those. She bought me a book, The History of Popular Music in America, which was written in 1947. So it told the story of pop music from the 19th century up to that time. And I devoured that and started looking for some of the songs that were mentioned in that book. And I also had a couple of books about jazz, so I'd look for Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke and people like that, and occasionally find some. And I read what I could find about lots of different kinds of music. Nowadays, there is just so much information. You can learn just about anything you want to know about older music, but that was not true in those days before the internet. There were only a few books about older forms of pop music, blues and jazz, and most of them, frankly, were not that great, but you get a little idea of what was going on. And So I'd study that, and through trial and error, the Salvation Army sold 78s for a nickel apiece. And so I could afford, I usually spent about $1 a week at the Salvation Army, so that's 20 records. Plus, they'd give me ones that were cracked or real beat up or something like that. So it was trial and error. If I liked something, I looked for more that were like that.
Right.
So all kinds of music. There was popular, classical, semi-classical, and music from the various immigrant groups that had come in. Minneapolis, lots of Scandinavians and Germans and Poles, so I'd find music from those cultures.
Was that where you first were introduced to the novelty music, or did that come later on?
Oh, yeah, well, the first novelty records I had, there were two things. Spike Jones, he was very popular in the 1940s. He was a big band leader. He sold lots of records. He was famous. And so my dad brought home some records of Spike Jones. Those were certainly the first novelty records, the first funny records that I heard, Cocktails for Two and the William Tell Overture and so on by Spike Jones. And then you'd hear novelty songs on the radio. In the 40s, there was the Too Fat Polka by Arthur Godfrey, for instance, and The Thing by Phil Harris was huge in 1950 when I was 9 years old. You'll never get rid of the boom, 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 no matter what you do. And that was a novelty song that was very big. And then getting towards the rock and roll era, you had The Flying Saucer, 1956, The Purple People Eater in 58. At any given time in the 50s and through the first half of the 60s, there was generally at least one or two novelty songs on the radio in the current rotation at the top 40 station. Some were great, some were easily forgotten, but there were a lot of them coming out. And so I was introduced to those, and my classmates certainly enjoyed The Purple People Eater. So I became kind of a fan of those, along with all the other kinds of music I was interested in. So I knew that stuff, even though it never really went quite to the forefront of my imagination, of my thoughts in music, until the Dr. Demento show came along, till that came into being. But I was a big fan of rock and roll in general. especially the rootsier stuff, the R&B, the rockabilly from the 50s and 60s. So Sun Records and all that, and Chess Records. I got my record budget finally got up to about $3 a week, late 50s.
Wow.
I usually buy one new record, which would more often than not be something by somebody like Muddy Waters or Jimmy Reed or John Lee Hooker. And then I spent my dollar at the Salvation Army and a dollar at a place that sold records that had been taken off jukeboxes for 19 cents apiece.
Hmm.
Got a lot of R&B from that place.
That's cool. You, after college, you graduated with a master's degree from UCLA.
And yeah, that's what brought me to Los Angeles.
Okay. And from there, you began working for a few different record labels, Specialty Records at first, and then Warner Brothers.
You have read my bio, Ethan.
I have.
Very good. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yeah, Specialty Records worked there for 3 years, and it was during that time that the Dr. Demento show started. That's when I met Steven Siegel, Stephen Kleen, and began doing guest shots on his show on KRRC.
Okay.
And then they gave me my own Sunday night shift on KRRC. Then I moved over to KMET, which was a bigger, more commercial station. But by that time, the Dr. Demento silliness format was fairly well established, and I was starting to get good ratings. So that I stayed KMET for quite a long time. Let's see, about 15 years.
Mm-hmm. So you were on the radio doing the Dr. Demento show and also working at a record company?
Yeah, I worked for Warner Brothers. I joined Warner Brothers in 1971, worked there till 79, doing a variety of behind-the-scenes type jobs.
Okay.
They put out my first album while I was there, but I also worked on lots of other albums, not necessarily comical at all. They had a program that they called the Lost Leaders. They put one or two of those out every year. It was a two-LP set, which was a sampler of various new Warner Brothers releases. And you could buy them. They were mail order only, and it was $2 for the whole full-length two-LP set, a double album, as they'd call them. And so each one would have maybe 25 or 30 cuts on it, and it would be, there'd be some big-name artists. There'd be Fleetwood Mac and James Taylor and Neil Young, people like that, and then there'd be all the new artists that Warner Brothers was trying to establish. So I was given the job of picking the songs and putting them in order and writing notes.
Okay.
So that I was involved in a lot of different kinds of music through that, and it was fascinating. I enjoyed that work a lot. I also wrote commercials for them. I wrote stuff for little magazines that they put out. I wrote publicity blurbs of all kinds. I wrote ads for print. I wrote some ads that appeared on the radio, and so did lots of stuff. And Frank Zappa was with Warner's for part of that time, so got to do a little more work with him.
At what point did you start doing the radio show full-time?
Well, the radio show kind of became, I'll say the radio show started paying enough so that I didn't need to do any, I didn't need to have a day job. That happened in 1979.
Okay.
So it took a while to build to the point where it could support me, because when I was just a guest on Stephen's show, it was for free, and then I started at $25 a week, and it gradually worked its way up.
Right.
So it worked its way up into four figures, so at that time I could support myself on it.
That was pretty early on, I guess, in your in having the show, the Dr. Demento show, that you met Al Yankovic. You spoke at his high school?
Right. I did not actually meet him at that time. He was, he would have been 13 or 14, and he said he was too shy to come up and meet me, but he was certainly impressed, and it was not long after that that he started sending me tapes. And I liked the tapes. They were real good, so I put them on the show, and they got better and better, and he gradually got to be more and more famous. So, I mean, Al's early career grew in a series of slow steps. He didn't become famous overnight.
Right.
First it was my show, and then he put out My Bologna, which got on a few other stations. Another one, Rides the Bus, which got on more stations and made the bubbling under charts in Billboard magazine. And then he got on MTV, and that started really to make him a star.
Now
it happened bit by bit. Yeah.
He met John Bermuda Schwartz on your show. Was
That's
John?
That's true. Yes.
Was John a comedy musician, or what was he doing?
Yes.
There?
Yeah. He had a band too, and he'd made some comedy songs. So he didn't make any commercial records at that time, but he made tapes, which he'd send to me, just like Al did. And,
okay.
It was just pure coincidence that I booked them both for the same show. Pure coincidence.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. So,
that happened to be, Al had just written the song Another One Rides the Bus. In fact, I'd spent some time with Al and a bunch of other people earlier that weekend, and he was just finishing up the lyrics to Another One Rides the Bus. He used to have a big blue loose-leaf notebook, and he would write lyrics in that. And so every so often we'd see Al sitting in a corner writing in that notebook, and what he was doing was writing the lyrics to Another One Rides the Bus.
Okay.
And so he came in to do his guest spot on my show. He'd been a guest on the show before. It wasn't his first time. But he said, "Oh, I've got a new song." And he showed me the lyrics so I could make sure that they weren't dirty or anything. Of course, I needn't have worried with Al, but... in any case, so he said, "Can I do this song on the show?" And I said, "Yes, you can." So he went out into the corridor while I was just playing records, and he went out into the corridor and started rehearsing the song. And at that point, he started talking to John Bermuda Schwartz and found out that John was a drummer, and asked him, "Well, why don't you bang on my accordion case and provide some rhythm?" So that's exactly what John did. And so that's how that performance went out over the air. And fortunately, we had a tape recorder rolling and recorded it in stereo on reel-to-reel tape. And that actual performance wound up being on Al's first album.
That's so incredible. Yes. It's such a great song too. It's amazing with Al's music, how it holds up, you know, being a parody song of a song that people may not even be familiar with nowadays. They can still listen to his older stuff and get a kick out of it.
That's right.
When did you start doing interviews on your show?
It was after a while. I mean, like Al would come in and I'd do like a brief interview with him or other artists like that. At first it was just they'd do a song live and I'd ask him a few questions. And then after I started doing the network show, which was in 74, it was a bigger deal. I was with a syndication company. And so we really had more of a way of bringing in artists who had made a name for themselves. My first interview on the air, I think, that was like that would be Doodles Weaver, who was one of the stars of the Spike Jones Band. He did the Fiedelbaum routine that was very famous with Spike Jones. And he was still around in 1973, so he came in, and I talked to him for some time on the show and played, of course, some of his famous records. And then after I got a different manager and went with Westwood One, which at that time was the biggest syndication company in radio, we started bringing in more guests at that time. So like I had George Carlin on four times. Oh, Frank Zappa was another one of the earlier ones. Had him on four times also. And so he was maybe the third or fourth somewhat lengthy interview that I did was Frank.
Who was your most notable or your favorite interview, I guess?
Oh, I don't know. George Carlin was on four times, and he was always brilliant. Though sometimes more serious than you might think, because I'd get on with George and we start talking about what is funny, what makes comedy, and start analyzing. That's just the way it happened to go with him. Probably the one interview that I was happiest with, how it turned out, was John Cleese.
Hmm. Wow.
He came in, actually, that was not on the Dr. Demento show originally. That was on the morning show of the station that I was on at the time in Los Angeles. And he had come in to promote the movie A Fish Called Wanda. And somebody at the station got the idea, well, why don't we have Dr. Demento interview John Cleese? And so they called me about two nights before it happened and said, can you come in the morning show and talk to John Cleese? And I said, well, sure. So I did, and that just, it really went well. He had come just to talk about A Fish Called Wanda, and I had seen a screening of it, so I had some questions about that. But we quickly got to talking about his Monty Python career, and he was happy to do that, and he seemed impressed with how much I knew about Monty Python, and so it just went real well.
That's great. That's so great. Now, was Weird Al ever working on your show? I think I heard somewhere that he used to answer phones. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. He was not like a paid employee or anything, but he would come in when he was living in Los Angeles, like summer. During summers when he wasn't going to school, mm-hmm. I'd say, well, you can come in and answer phones anytime you want. I mean, he wasn't a big star. He was just right. Somebody whose tapes I played on the show, and I knew he was real talented, but in no way was he a star yet. So he was happy to come in, and Barnes and Barnes came in too sometimes.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
Of course, the other people who were members of my crew, my first crew members who became well known, though just on my show, not nationally, Captain Chaos and Jungle Judy. So they were my first phone answerers, or at least my first that really became well known, and people began having fantasies about Jungle Judy, and she did a couple of appearances with me wearing a leopard skin suit, and so that was fun. And then Captain Chaos would dress up like a sea captain. those were names that I just hung on them. I
mean, oh, really?
It was Steve and Judy, and I decided I was Dr. Demento. They might as well have funny names, too. So that's how they became Captain Chaos and Jungle Judy.
When did you start wearing your top hat?
I think it was the first time I went to the Grammys. And I needed to rent a tux, and my manager said, oh, you look great in that. So that's how it started.
Oh, that's great. It's become such an icon for your career.
Yeah.
Are you still doing interviews on your current iteration of the Dr. Demento show?
Not as much, but once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I do a lot of them on the phone using the same setup I'm using right now. Mm-hmm. That's how I did. That's how I've done an interview with Al Yankovic every time he's had a new album. So there was one for the new album too, the newest album, Mandatory Fun.
Would you have ever expected all those years ago that Al would go on to have a number one record? It's just
maybe not when he first started, but like I said, his career progressed in steps and. Every year, he seemed to do something bigger and better and more spectacular than the year before. So it was a series of steps. So, and I was always happy and delighted with each one.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, at first there were the homemade tapes, and then there were the slightly more elaborate tapes, and then there started to be videos, and then he started directing his own videos and producing his own albums, and so it just, the Weird Al thing just kept growing.
Now, you still have some of the earlier tapes, including the infamous Dr. D Superstar song.
Yes.
Are those ever, are some of the ones that haven't been aired ever going to be out there? Is there any kind of plans to release them?
Well, I don't know about Dr. D Superstar, but a good many otherwise unreleased Weird Al cuts, demos, and a few songs that were never put on regular records. Some of them came out on some CDs that we used to do for our fan club called Dr. Demento's Basement Tapes. And if you want to know about those, you can well, one way to kind of get introduced to the world of dementia is to go on Facebook and look for the official Dr. Demento Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody can contribute to that, and anybody can look at that, and I often answer questions on that page. And it's a way of keeping up with the show, and people can ask me about my old stuff.
Was there any...
The old Dr. Demento basement tapes, we cannot really sell those commercially, but if you join the Demento Society, you can acquire some of those. That's kind of a little secret that we have.
Oh, that's great. Is there any reason? I've always been so curious about Dr. D Superstar. Is there any reason in particular that it was not included on a basement tape, or is there anything about that song?
No. I guess maybe I didn't quite feel it was going to be a real theme song of mine. Al was not a star, remember, at that time. He was just a guy who sent me tapes. And that was fun. I mean, maybe I'll bring it back.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay. I think he would agree that it was not the best thing he ever did, and so Al is not very enthusiastic about my letting some of his real early stuff get out. As you might understand, I mean, starting out.
Yeah.
His career was trial and error at first, like anybody's.
I'm not saying
that was an error, but.
It's definitely interesting to hear those. It's fun to hear, you know. I understand where Al wouldn't want to be out there, but I think the super fans are really interested in that kind of stuff. And I think
right.
I think it's really great that you've released what you have. It's really cool to have those out there. Now you recorded Shaving Cream. You put that out a few times, and you would perform it. Was there any other songs that you had recorded or performed?
No. Not really, no. Because I'm not really a singer, as you can tell from hearing that, but that's kind of within my limited range. And it also, because I could make up new verses for it all the time, that was a logical thing for me to do, rather than just trying to sing something that somebody else had sung better. If I could do new verses to it, that added some interest to it. When I performed in Albany, I probably made up a verse that was related to something that was going on around there at that time.
I can't remember
it now, but yeah. But I do stuff like that.
When you would tour with Weird Al, would you just sing Shaving Cream, or what other kind of stuff would you do?
Oh, I play music from the show.
Oh, okay.
That's so basically what I do, a half-hour miniature version of the Dr. Demento show.
Oh, okay.
So I'd be introducing, I'd mostly play the hits from the show. I'd play condensed versions of Fish Heads and Dead Puppies, and there'll be a little Zappa, a little Spike Jones, kind of the history of comedy music in a half-hour show.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I did one show. It was in 1985 in Kingston, New York. That's not too far from you, I don't think.
No, not too far.
And as I found out a long time later, there in the audience at age 11, there was his parents, was Jimmy Fallon.
Wow.
And that was the first concert he ever went to, Weird Al Yankovic with me doing my half-hour show. It was a beautiful old theater, so I remember it because of that, and also because a hurricane had blown through and the gig was almost canceled, but the hurricane kind of just brushed the edge of Kingston, so the show went on.
Wow. That's
so amazing. I remember it because of that, and then later, when Jimmy Fallon, there was a big long piece on him in Vanity Fair magazine when he took over at The Tonight Show, and there was a couple of paragraphs about how much he enjoyed the Dr. Demento show when he was a kid.
Oh, that's so great. It must be an amazing feeling to have influenced all these really amazing comedians and comedy musicians.
Yes, it does make me swell with pride a little bit.
So, yeah, it's amazing. I am a huge just comedy music fan. It's mostly what I listen to. I'm not really into classic rock or new stuff. And
okay.
it's really great to have people like you making that possible for, you know, people like me who are demented as well.
Well, you're most welcome, Ethan. Happy to do it. I mean, it's been a lot of fun for me too.
Yeah, it's an amazing career. I'm looking through some of the timeline stuff, and I had some questions. These are, I guess, kind of more specific questions, but I know you did. You've done a number of different iterations of the show. There was a Best of the Dr. Demento on XM Radio. There was the Daily Dose of Dementia.
Not too many folks remember that one.
Were you part of those, or was that like a record company taking your
own
stuff?
Oh, yeah, I was involved. Okay. I was involved. That was the radio, the Daily Dose of Dementia was something one of my radio syndicators thought up. He said, let's do a 5-minute feature for morning shows. And so I did.
And okay.
It ran for, what, 2-3 years, something like that. And then it didn't run anymore. It's just the way things are.
Right.
And then the XM show that ran for a couple of years, and then we asked for a raise, and they said, "No, we got our own comedy guys."
Ugh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I had an odd problem with XM Radio. Yeah. I mean, they carried that show for a while, but they said to me, "You know, your stuff is too adult for our family channel and not dirty enough for our adult channel."
That's so weird.
So what could I say? If they'd offered me more money, I would have done a show for them tailored to the particular level of cleanness or dirtiness that they wanted. But they weren't willing to go that far. They were shooting their whole wad on Howard Stern, I guess.
Okay.
Now
that you're not restricted, since you are online, are you playing racier stuff?
Somewhat.
Yeah.
I mean, like when the S word comes up in the course of a normal song, I don't have to bleep it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the F word. Well, my show now online, it's rated PG-13, so I go by basically the guidelines that were be used for a PG-13 movie. Like, you can use the F word once or twice as long as as it is not specifically descriptive of a sexual act. I mean, the F word, as you know, is used in many other contexts besides specifically describing sex.
Right.
So I learned something interesting. When I first started being online only, I thought, oh, the sky's the limit. I can play all this racy stuff. But then I realized that a lot of my audience is people who listen with their kids.
Right.
And so I struck that compromise of keeping it PG-13. And about once a month or once every 6 weeks, I do bonus tracks where I play stuff that maybe is a little more candid, more uncensored than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I run those at the end of the show and keep them separate for those who are listening with their kids.
That's great. I read that a prior company, when you were doing the FM show, that they wouldn't let you play It's a Gas.
That's true, because it wasn't XM. It was Westwood One.
Okay.
The major syndicator that I worked with from 1978 to 80, 1978 to 92, yeah, a long time. And the chief executive of that company did not like things that had to do with bodily secretions and gross noises. It was just his taste. I think he didn't want the show to seem like it was more juvenile. He wanted it to seem a little more adult.
Of course.
So, and he was paying the money, so It's a Gas went on a vacation for a while.
That's too bad. It's a Gas is great.
But they were very liberal and tolerant about all kinds of things, so mm-hmm. I can't blame them.
Just not the burping.
Right. Yeah, he didn't like burping, and he didn't like things that featured little kids. He wasn't very fond of Dragnet Goes to Kindergarten, because it's narrated by a child. It was written by Steve Allen, but it was narrated by a child, so they didn't like that much. But hey, that's the way it is. You're right. Working for somebody who's paying your salary. You do the job that they expect,
right.
More or less.
So there was never any tension or anything because of what you couldn't play?
Not really, no.
That's good. In the past...
And of course, we went back and forth over... there was Frank Zappa's, and bleep this if you must, but it's Frank Zappa recorded this song called Titties and Beer. And on KMET in Los Angeles, it was the most popular Frank Zappa song that I played for a long time. But we went back and forth over the word titties. There were earnest discussions about, they had decided, no, we can't say tits on the radio, but maybe titties isn't quite as bad. And then they got some complaints about it, so I had to take the titties out again. And I put in this cuckoo clock noise, beep boop, instead of the word titties. So cut that whole part out if you want. I don't know how your management is at WCDB. Of course, if you're on late in the evening, it might not matter.
I mean, and what are they going to do? It's my last show. They can fire me.
Good point. Good point there, Ethan. Yes.
Now, has there been any, over the past 45 years, any extended period of time where you have not been doing the Dr. Demento show in some capacity? Or has it just been a nonstop?
No, it's been nonstop.
Could you ever see yourself not doing it?
Oh, if I can't stand up to the microphone and can't put a show together that's good and entertaining... then probably I wouldn't want to do it anymore. But as long as I'm physically and mentally able to do it, I'm fine with keeping it going.
That's
great. Really don't know the life of not doing a show every week. Of course, I've never had the life of doing a show every day, with the exception of a 3-month stint in San Francisco very early in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for a station for 3 months playing regular music. It was freeform, but it was not funny. So I did do that at one very early point in my career, 1971, KMPX in San Francisco, which has gone to radio heaven.
Seems like a lot of radio stations are going to radio heaven lately.
Yeah. Usually the frequencies remain, but the management of the station and often the call letters will change.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, I just lost my place. I'm sorry. In syndication, and when you were doing your show, when it was syndicated, what was the time frame of recording the show to actually having it air? Was it a week, or was it 3 months in advance?
It varied from time to time. At Westwood One, it was as long as 3 weeks, because they actually pressed the show up on LP records, and that's how it was sent to stations. So that took a little time. Right now, I wrap up the show on Friday, and it goes online the next morning.
Oh, cool. Do you prefer having it coming out faster like that?
Yes. Yeah. Right. It can be more topical, more timely.
Mm-hmm. Would you, in pre-recording, would you have to say stuff like... referencing the date of when it was airing or anything like that? Would you have to be careful to not?
Yeah, I'd have to watch for that sometimes, though I'd usually try and not do as much stuff that's totally tied down to one day, for instance, or even one weekend, because not every station played it on the same day.
Right. Okay. There was recently there was a Kickstarter campaign for a documentary about your life. Has there been any?
Oh yes.
Have there been any other documentaries, or is this the first?
That's the first.
The first one.
That is the first. Yes. So, and it's still going on. I can't tell you when it's going to be released, but we've got 80 hours of footage.
Oh, wow.
So, and some great interviews. So we're certainly looking forward to it coming out, but we need to get a little more funding together. I say we because, of course, I'm very much involved in it, but it's not my company or anything like that.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, I'm hoping that gets finished soon so everybody can see it because there's a lot of great stuff in it.
Yeah,
so,
I'd love to see it.
Looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. Under the Smogberry Trees.
Where does that title come from? Under the Smogberry Trees?
Oh, that's what I used to say at the beginning of the show, and I've started saying it again now. It was I heard somebody else saying, oh, here we are under the beautiful palm trees in sunny Los Angeles. So it was kind of a riff on that. I heard somebody else say something like that. It might have even been on TV. But anyway, so I came up with Under the Smogberry Trees because in the 70s, Los Angeles had a really severe smog problem. It's not as bad now, but it used to be your eyes would burn when you'd go outside.
Oh, man.
But it's great. Much better now.
No,
it's much better now because we're burning all that unleaded fuel.
Right. And soon maybe electric, which will be even less.
Yes, right. Though of course, electricity has got to come from somewhere. They sometimes make that with coal, and that's just as dirty.
Now, I'm interested to hear about your collection of music and records. You have like some extremely rare things that I saw that different record labels and musicians have like come to you to make copies of.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How big is the collection?
Yeah, lots of old blues and country and Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton and people like that. And but of course, what is certainly most notable about my collection is all the funny stuff.
Right.
And those records are not necessarily worth eye-popping sums of money, but it's great to have a resource like that. And, I mean, I've got some of Weird Al's first tapes, and there's only one of those.
Right.
Unless he kept copies, and I'm not sure he did.
Right. What is the size of your collection over 200,000, right?
It's hundreds of thousands. I don't have an exact figure for you, Ethan.
That's amazing. It's
lots.
Do you have it categorized?
I'm standing in the midst of them right now. I mean, there's a building on our property which began life as a garage, and it's been added onto, and it's become my studio and my record room.
Hmm.
And then some of the records are on off-premises storage, too.
Okay. It's incredible.
So there's only so much room. Yeah, they take up lots of room, and they weigh a lot.
Are you still adding to
Even
the collection?
Even CDs, you get enough of them, they weigh a whole lot.
Yeah. Are you still adding to your collection?
Mostly just the stuff that comes in for the show these days.
Mm-hmm.
Though I still enjoy a little bit of contemporary music here and there, but in most cases I'll just be adding those digitally.
Mm-hmm. Is there any particular artist that you collect?
Of course, the comedy giants from Spike Jonze to George Carlin, and I certainly try to be complete on people like that, mm-hmm. to have everything that they did in some form or another.
When you're recording your show, are you still playing some stuff from vinyl, or is it all digital at this point?
Well, it all goes to digital at some point, because it's a little too cumbersome to actually play a 78 on the show, and have it queued up perfectly and all that. So I will transfer those to CD. I have specialized equipment. It takes a lot of different styli to make sure that all the different 78s play well. And if I do them on digital, I can get rid of some of the pops and ticks and noise and things like that, make sure they're at the right speed and all that stuff. So there is certainly an advantage to having it all digital. I haven't really put it all in the cloud or anything like that. I'm still a little bit old school in that most of what I play is in the CD format, either commercial CDs or ones that I've burned myself on the same machine that I'm recording this interview on. It's a Tascam CD-RW 900 Mark II Professional CD recorder.
I mean, there's something just... for me personally, something to having a physical thing that it's recorded on rather than just, you know, digital magnets.
I definitely agree with you there, Ethan. I'm not necessarily one of those who is convinced that vinyl sounds better than any other format, but there is certainly something wonderful about having a good piece of music or comedy on the original vinyl or on a well-done reissue, something like that. You know, being able to see the artwork in full size and to hold something in your hand that actually you can see the undulations in the grooves and the different patterns of light that reflect off the grooves. If you are into staring at vinyl records as they play, you can often kind of get an idea, even without listening, what sort of rhythm the music had. Like anything done with a drum machine makes very regular patterns that you can see in the light reflected off the grooves. And that's true of any kind of disc record, even 78s. Of course, they didn't have drum machines back then, but if you had a drummer who was very metronomic and kept real good time, you can see the very regular pattern in the light reflected off the grooves.
Wow.
You can also tell when the music speeds up or slows down, which happened a lot on older records before they had drum machines. So
I've never looked too closely. That's a really cool thing. I'll have to check that out.
Well, as you people who are fascinated with records or any other kind of media can get pretty obsessive about things like that, even more than I am.
Yeah, I have a collection of records, but I don't think I've ever played any of them. I think I need to get a record player so I can check them out.
Yeah, you need to get a record player.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a pretty decent turntable for a couple $100.
Right.
Don't buy a Crosley. They're a junk.
Crosley, okay. I'll stay away from it.
But actually, you can find real good turntables at stores catering to DJs.
Okay.
They're kind of fading away since a lot of DJs have gone to using hard drives, but most big music stores that have a DJ department will still have some decent turntables, even ones that play 78s.
Cool.
Of course, for 78s, you've got to get separate styli if you want them to sound decent, but that's another story that we probably don't need to get into. But there again, you can find all you want to know about that online.
Right. What is the ultimate novelty song? Is it Fish Heads?
Well, the most popular one on my show would be Fish Heads, Beating Out Dead Puppies by a Nose.
Mm-hmm.
Now They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha, is also right up there. Weird Al is the most popular artist. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Is there an ultimate one to you that you just, when you think of your show, what one song comes to mind?
I can't go beyond what the audience has acclaimed. At any given time, I'll probably like something new. If there's something new that comes out and it's real good, then that'll be my favorite song for a while.
It's a good answer.
Yes.
I just, you know, this has been amazing. I want to ask you about you've had so many cameos and really cool things. You've been on The Simpsons and all those different Weird Al videos, UHF. What was your experience like doing the cameos?
Well, it was different. The Simpsons was a lot of fun. You know, when they do a show like that, the very first thing they do after they've written the script, they do the voices. Mm-hmm. The animation comes later. So
okay.
There were all the cast members in street clothes sitting in chairs in a semicircle, each one with a mic and each one with a music stand holding their script. Mm-hmm. So they go through the script from beginning to end, doing very frequent retakes. They'll do each line maybe three or four times till everybody's happy with it. Then they'll go on to the next line. And my part in The Simpsons, it was at the very beginning of the show, so we did that first. And then I was able to sit there and watch them do the rest of it, which took a couple hours maybe. And then we all shook hands and autographed stuff for each other and said goodbye, and that was it. And it was lots of fun.
That's awesome.
The Weird Al videos, of course, they were all different, but generally each one took at least a day.
Okay.
So I'd put on my suit or whatever I was wearing, and I'd do my part, and then I'd hang around while they did the other parts. And but they were all different, of course. And I guess I lost on Jeopardy is the one where I have the most face time on screen.
Yeah. I always loved it, almost the same way that in the new superhero movies, you're always looking for Stan Lee. When you're watching a Weird Al video, you want to be looking for Dr. Demento.
Right. And then, of course, in UHF, I have a small part. My part in that was going to be a little bit longer, but they had to do a lot of cutting in that movie because nobody wanted a 2.5-hour light comedy for young people. So so they had to cut a lot of stuff. So it wound up being just a very brief cameo, but I had a little bit longer part originally.
What was it supposed to be originally?
Oh, it involved me with shaving cream, and I had a couple of some sort of an interaction with Michael Richards as the janitor. We had a little back and forth dialogue.
Oh, that's great.
I can't remember all of it now. Anyway, it was. But there were a lot of good things that wound up on the cutting room floor. It wound up being a real good movie. So
yes,
and I got a free trip to Tulsa for that. You know, most of the interiors were done in Tulsa, and what they did was there was a department store that had shut down. They were in a recession in all through the oil country that year.
Okay,
so they found this whole department store in this mall that had been closed, and so it was just this big empty space that they could get relatively cheaply and put all their sets and things up and do their movie and with relatively little time pressure. So that was a good thing for them. And maybe the nicest thing, it was in the middle of the summer and it was 105 degrees and 95% humidity. So the nicest thing was the abandoned department store was at one end of this mall and our hotel was at the other end, so we did not have to go outside when we went back to the hotel. So that was UHF.
Wow.
In Tulsa, Oklahoma. some of the interiors were done in LA, but most of it in Tulsa. And that was fun being there and watching the other scenes that were done and watching them get together. Mm-hmm. And have their conference, watching the dailies after each day's shooting, which anybody who's ever made a movie will tell you about that.
Right. Yeah. It's been an amazing career, Dr. Demento.
Oh, yes. And Ethan, I'm honored to be on what is unfortunately your last show, but may you go on to greater heights in the future, wherever the future takes you.
Thank you.
Always be around joy and laughter and fun, Comedy Pipe Radio, and and don't forget to stay demented.
Thank you to Dr. Demento for that amazing interview. and taking so much time with me to do such a in-depth look at his career and his life and his accomplishments. And of course, he if you notice, it sounded like he was in the room with me, but we were, of course, on different coasts. He was so nice and gracious to record his end of the interview from his own personal studio, which was very cool.